what used to be normal and it used to be attainable, if you actually put that life on a bell curve, it would put you so far on the right that I would venture to guess maybe 5 to 7 to 8% of the US population will realize it, right? You wanna make what most people don't, you're gonna have to take risks most people won't. There's always a place for frugality. But you know what should take a higher place than frugality? Is producing, is going out into the marketplace, being valuable, getting paid for the value you create, because that's how you're gonna get the kind of life that you desire, the kind of life that's possible. We have not given people any financial literacy about how to allocate capital, how to invest their money. And so they're like, I don't know what else to do with my money. I talked about how you wanting what used to be considered like normal middle class is now moving you right on the bell curve, right? So this is what I'll say. What's up, Jake? Last week, we had a conversation about what does it take to thrive on one income? And I think that conversation was great. It was also really high level, a little bit esoterical. And so today I think the follow-up to that is, what does it actually look like to thrive on one income, right? Last week we talked about how you do that and this idea of creating value in the marketplace and being rewarded for the value you create, but we didn't really get into any specifics. So somebody might have watched or listened to that and thought, okay, but what does it actually take? Like, how do you actually do it? And so I thought this week we could just have a conversation about what is thriving financially and doing it on one income even look like in your mind, right? Because you're on this journey, you're trying to pursue this goal. And if you're trying to do it, obviously there's other people who are trying to do it. So what does it really look like to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, we talked a little bit about it last week too. I really want to provide a stable enough income for my wife to stay home. I really want to be at the point where we can start a family and be able to afford basic necessities of having, you know, an extra person or two or three in the house. You know, and the biggest thing for me is I really want to be able to, which I don't feel like I've had to this point, is have a sort of stability to capitalize on opportunities when they arise. I think that's when I think of thriving in my brain of what does it look like to thrive financially, and especially off one income, is being able to capitalize on those opportunities. And when I say opportunities, I mean, there's always opportunities where it arises to go, man, if I had 20, 30, 40 extra $1,000 right now, that'd be a sweet opportunity to take. And having had to miss those in the past, it's like, I don't want to miss those again, you know? So in terms of what it looks like thriving, in my mind, that's kind of what it looks like. I'm not sure if other people would resonate with that, but that's what I see. So,
okay, that's cool. But let's dig deeper. So thriving is you're making enough money, your wife can stay home, she can raise some kids, but what else? I mean, I think in our conversations in the past, it's like, and I think for a lot of people that are listening to this or watching this, it would be, I don't have to be worried about money. I don't want to have to be anxious about money. I want to be able to, you know, take my family out to dinner every once in a while if I want. I mean, what does it look like from a weekly, monthly, yearly standpoint of like, well, what does thriving really mean?
Right. Yeah. I mean,
if do you I own to... a house? Do you have like paint the picture?
Yeah, I guess. I think there's some basic necessities for me that I look at and I'm like, man, that's a real strain of not having financial income for that part of it. It's just a real strain of, man, I really like going out to dinner and I really like treating my wife to dinner, not having to worry about the bill necessarily, not like throwing $1,000 at dinner, but sure, you know, like you going to a nice dinner, like once a week, you know, going on a date night. You know, having a reliable vehicle. Like I've driven kind of a turd for a long time, and you know, having a nice car drive around, I think is always a desire. I think owning a home is, I always have considered renting to be, you know, giving somebody else money when I'd love to be getting that money myself, even though I may not be in the right position now to buy a home. But man, I think it's just having the luxuries of being able to spend money if I wanted to. I wouldn't say I'm overly an overspender, but I mean, I like my nice things sometimes, you know, my hunting gear. I like to pitch a couple $100 at a nice thing, a nice set of hunting gear every once in a while. And so I guess if I were to paint a perfect picture, it would be being able to live modestly, but have certain luxuries that I've had to give up in the past, I guess. That makes sense.
Yeah. So I just wrote down some notes because I want to read them back to you, right? You want to be able to be in a comfortable home, have cars you can rely on, be able to go out to dinner, maybe do some entertainment here and there, nothing extravagant. You want to be able to have some hobbies that don't feel like you can't experience or enjoy, right? To me, that sounds like what we used to call the American dream.
That's right.
Sounds like sounds like what we used to call just a normal middle class life.
Mm.
So it doesn't sound like what we're talking about is, you know, is necessarily like the life of the rich and famous. And I think the reason I wanted you to do that is because I think that's the reality for most people. And the whole reason that I came to you and I said, hey, I have this idea, and I finally feel like it's clear to me what we should be talking to people about. It's that what used to be normal and it used to be attainable, if you actually put that life on a bell curve, it would put you so far on the right that I would venture to guess maybe 5 to 7 to 8% of the US population will realize it, right? What used to be normal, and I get it, like part of the reason it's not normal anymore is because our lifestyles have become more extravagant. What we want, we don't want a 3-bedroom, you know, 1 or 1.5 bath house anymore with either no garage or a 1-car garage. We want, you know, 4 bedrooms, we want 2.5 baths, we want 3 or 4-car garages. I understand all that, but I think there's more to it than just our tastes have changed. I think part of, and I mentioned it in the last video, but I didn't follow up very well with what I meant is, you know, we live in a society where we don't have real money. We don't have sound money. And so if you look back since 1971, we got off the gold standard. We've just had inflation ever since. We've lived through the last several years through some of the worst inflation that we've had as a country in our entire history. And I think what we're seeing is we're seeing, especially young people, because you guys are just trying to start, it feels less and less attainable to live what used to be just a normal middle-class life, to live what most people desire, which is nothing extravagant, right? They just want to be able to live a life free from, I want to say, like worry and angst over things that they seem, that they feel are just kind of necessities, right? Does that resonate?
Yeah. I mean, and one thing I'd add is looking at, you know, that sort of group that you're talking about, my generation, you could say, of people are wanting to live that American dream life that I kind of tried to highlight. And I mean, it feels like they're still doing it, but they're doing it under credit card loans. And, you know, I heard some interesting statistic of, you know, people in my age group, 20 to 30 years old, there's like over 50% of them are missing at least one payment on their credit cards. And there's another stat of like, you know, 40% of the people are using buy now, pay later options for basic stuff like a TV at Best Buy or something, you know? And it's like, there's navigating this right now is like, I think about it a lot of like, we are the first person that is experiencing this economy right now. And so it feels a little bit confusing. And so I think for you, the question I'd have for you is, you know, navigating now, what do you see the through line is?
Yeah. So, and this is where I think, you know, you're 24 now. So when I was 24, we were going through just starting the Great Recession, right? So your generation's going through this kind of extreme inflationary environment, and mine went through basically an extreme deflationary environment. We went through an environment where everything was crashing. families were losing their retirements, people were losing their jobs, their houses, et cetera. And so it's like, it's different, but it's similar. And what the through line in my mind is how do you thrive in uncertain times? How do you thrive in environments that are chaotic? And what I want to say, and I think is hopefully will be helpful to you guys, is this is not going to go away. Like this chaotic environment in many ways exists because we don't have real money, because we can print money out of thin air. We can, like, after that deflationary environment that I lived through at your age, they printed all this money. And then over the last 4 years, 5 years, they've printed 40% of the dollars in existence, right? And so this is what's going to continue to happen. And so what I want to help you guys explore is, how do you actually survive and thrive in those environments? And here's the reality. The reality is, if you're not doing things that are different than everybody else, you won't. So, and maybe we can dovetail and I'll give a practical example. So you came to me recently and said, I think I want to buy a house. And I can get pre-approved for, let's say, somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000, okay? Mm-hmm. And if I put 20% down, you know, then I can probably meet the monthly payment requirements and all those things. And so I took you through an exercise, and maybe we can do that here. And I said, okay, well, let's talk about that. If you paid $500,000, you put 20% down, that's 100 grand. You're going to finance $400,000 at, let's say, 6.5%. That's going to be, let's say, $2,500 a month. Plus taxes and insurance, assuming you don't have any HOA fees, let's say you're at $2,800 a month. Plus utilities, another $250. Let's say you're all in at $3,000 a month. Well, if you don't want to be cost burdened by your housing, you don't want your housing costs to be more than, let's say, 30% of your income. Well, that means you need to make between $10,000 and $11,000 a month in order to own that $500,000 house after have putting $100,000 of capital into it, right? And so then the question becomes, is that a good use of your capital right now? Is that a good use of your resources? Because you could probably rent the same house instead of paying $3,000 a month for $2,000 a month. Then you'd save another $12,000 a year. And so, see, this is where I think for your generation, if you want to live this life that we're talking about, we have to think through the sequencing of what matters in what order. Because what we talked about in the last video, I want to bring forward into today's video, which is you have to learn how to make money first. Because what you don't want to have happen is you don't want to go into that house, be locked into that $3,000 mortgage, and then take all of your opportunity to make more money away because you have to have a certain job, right? Because if you have a certain job that's paying you, let's say, $8,000 a month, $100,000 a year, but there's no clear path to, let's say, double it so you can live this life you're talking about. You can have your wife stay home. You can afford to go to dinner, yada, yada, yada. If you lock yourself into this job right now because you want to buy this home, and then you're going to part with $100,000 that you could use in other ways, plus an extra $12,000 a year, you might actually just be doing it out of sequence. And a lot of times, it's done out of sequence, not because people are trying to do out of sequence. It's being done out of sequence because it's what people are told to do. People are told, don't rent. You're just paying off somebody else's mortgage. It's like, well, yeah and no. Because if you can rent for $1,000 a month less than you could buy, and you can keep your $100,000, you would be nuts to buy, right? Mm-hmm. Because on that loan, if you're paying, let's say, $2,500 a month, maybe in the first year, maybe like $500 is principal, right? So you're really paying down the loan $6,000 a year in the first year. It's like, it doesn't actually make a lot of sense to buy. But people want to buy. They want to own a home. I understand that. So what I talk to you about, and what I'm going to reiterate here, is what would probably be the better idea is you move to Florida. You rent a house for a year. You keep your 100 grand. Right. And then you save the extra 12,000 in that first year. You figure out what you like, where you like to live, where you don't like to live. And then in that year, you focus on maybe you can take a job where you don't have to make as much, but maybe it has way more upside. Maybe it's a sales job, or maybe it's a job where you have a smaller salary, but you have a bigger upside on what you produce, right? You give yourself more flexibility instead of locking yourself into this thing that now you're committed to for the next 30 years. Right. And then you continue, maybe you take some of that 100 grand and you invest it into your own skill set. right? Maybe you take $10,000 of that money and you get some communication training, you get some vocational training, you get some AI training. Like you actually invest in that skill set to help you go from making, let's say, 100 grand a year to 150 grand a year. Because think about this. Let's say you lock yourself into a job and this year you make 100 and next year you get a 3% raise, you made 103. Let's say the other opportunity or the other option is you take a job this year that you make 80,000, but you don't lock yourself into the house. You keep your 100, you save another 12 the next year. Let's say you use that 12 you save to invest in yourself. And let's say by investing in your skills and getting better and at creating more value, like we talked in the last video, now the next year you don't make 80, you make 125 or you make 110. And then that skill compounds the next year, you make 150. You see, because it's just a matter of sequencing, you're going to own a home someday if you do it right. Mm. Because a home isn't just about, is it a good investment like people think? A home is about, is it a place that you call home? Do you get to own it? There's more qualitative value than people often give credit to. They always want to talk about the quantitative value. And quantitative is important, especially when you're trying to sequence it. But here's the deal. My goal, my hope for you would be you get to the point where you're making enough because you're creating enough value in society that you don't have to really think so much about the quantitative goal. You can just think about the qualitative part. Does that make sense?
No, it does. Yeah, it does. I think if I'm understanding you correctly, it's almost like my focus on trying to buy a house right now is sort of becoming my ball and chain from preventing me from the actual thing that I want, which would be, you know, financial freedom, basically.
Yeah, exactly. So people often are buying a house because they think it's going to be a great investment that will give them some level of financial freedom down the road. But the reality is your house is never an investment unless you're willing to sell it. And because real estate, like my business is real estate, right? So real estate, if you just use round math, depending on where you are in the country, every time you sell a piece of real estate, it's going to cost you, let's say, anywhere from 7 to 10%. So your house has to actually go up in value 7 to 10% just to actually get your money back if you want to sell it, right? So if we were to prioritize, if we were up to put a list of your goals in priority, right, owning a home isn't a goal aside from what it will do for you, right? So like, what does owning a home do for people? Well, for some people, they think it will help them become wealthier, right? For other people, it's like, well, people can't tell me what to do because I own it. So let's say those are two priorities, right? But for you, what we've been talking about is actually higher up on the priority list is how do I generate enough income to be able to live comfortably? So let me ask you, Jake, if you had enough income coming in right now that you could do all the things that we started out this conversation with, so you know, cars that you could rely on, taking your wife out to dinner, being able to do your hobbies, living a modest, comfortable life. If you could do all those things and your wife could stay home, but for the next 3 years you were renting and you were saving an extra, let's say, $10,000 a year plus the $100,000 you had, would you be okay with that? Do you think that you would be achieving most of your goals?
Yeah, I mean, You wrote it out right there. I think I'd be achieving 90% of what I'm looking
exactly.
for.
Exactly. Right. So then the focus, right? The focus then shouldn't, like, think about if you spent that, if you, in the next 6 months, if you spent 200 hours trying to get all your ducks in a row to buy a house, and then let's say you bought the house and then you spent another 300 hours doing the cleaning and the little remodel and the this and the that. So you got 500 hours into this house. Do you think, if you spent the same 500 hours making yourself more valuable in the marketplace, finding opportunities to create value in the marketplace, that you're more likely to make progress towards the primary goal? Or do you think getting the house is going to make you more progress towards the primary goal?
Yeah, I mean, I think looking at it from now, it's like saving on, not necessarily buying the house right now, it seems like a more strategic move in terms of long-term goals. I would say just thinking of, you know, if I were to look at this from a perspective of I'm not even looking to buy a house right now, let's say I'm 50, 60 years old, whatever. I think there's something here where it's almost like, one, I think there's a lot of the community that's kind of pushing towards, the reason why they're pushing you towards the buying a house is because my parents, like my mom says, oh yeah, I bought my first house when I was 20, you know? The other part is, you know, there's a statistics, I don't know the exact number, but it was 50, 60 years ago, you could buy a house for cash with 5 years of your income. And right now it's 20 years of your income, you could buy a house. I don't remember the exact term, but there's an exponent there. That's the affordability of buying a home right now, or not even buying a home, just living costs is exponentially higher in proportion to your income, right? So I guess navigating that for us, you're saying the one solution for that would be saving on the home, waiting on the home, building income that you would save for renting versus owning, and applying that to basically building your sort of rapport, I guess, or investing in yourself, investing in a skill that's multiplying your income to be able to later on have a better experience buying?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think about it, and maybe this is different than other people think about it, but, and maybe this will help even clarify where we're going with all this, is I talked about the bell curve. I talked about how you wanting what used to be considered like normal middle class is now moving you right on the bell curve, right? So this is what I'll say. In the future, the people who are going to thrive financially are the ones who own assets. Okay. So some people will say, but Zach, you just said not to buy the asset. Mm. And it's like, well, yeah, because it's not productive. Your house produces nothing. Your house is not an asset unless you're willing to sell it and move to another house. And if you sell it and you got to move to another house, you're probably going to spend about the same amount of money. So it's really not an asset unless you want to downsize, right? And you want to take the money from downsizing and put it to work into some other productive asset. So the way that I think about this, which I think is different than other people, is other people are focused on how do I save an extra $100 a month, $200 a month, $300 a month. I'm focused on how do I make an extra 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, because I'm producing 10 times that in the marketplace. Like, I think our conversations are probably only really going to be helpful for people who have a propensity to look at life that way, because I look at it and I go, they're going to keep printing more money. They're going to keep making, like what you said, you might, I don't know the exact statistics, but let's say you could have bought a house 50 years ago on 5 years of your salary, and today it's 10 years. That's not going to change. Our currency is going to get devalued more and more. Just in the last week, I think they said it dropped, the US dollar dropped 11%. They asked Trump how he felt about it. He said, it's great. Why? Because he knows that we're in debt. They're trying to devalue our currency. This is what you guys and me, I'm not that much older than you, this is what we are going to face. So how do you counteract that? How do you thrive financially? Okay, my point is, there's two ways to do it. The first way is you got to figure out how to make money. You got to figure out how to actually make enough money to combat or overcome those realities, because they're not going away. The second thing is you got to learn how to keep your money. Okay. A lot of people are good at making money and then they lose it all. And then they got to start over. And then they got to start over. Warren Buffett says the number one rule of investing is never lose money. And then he says, and then number two is don't forget number one. So you have to learn how to first make money, second, keep your money, and then third, grow your money. So I think about it in that order. I go, Jake, if you want to live the life you want to live, step one is make money. And I'm not saying like make money because it's the most important thing in the world. I'm saying make money because the financial reality is you can spend all your time stressing out about how to, or thinking about, or scheming about how to just make an extra $300. Or you can take the same amount of energy and think about how do I build a business or create a business or get compensated inside of a business somebody else owns for what I produce. Okay. That's how you make more money. You produce more value in the marketplace. Then how do I keep my money? Well, one way to keep your money in this instance is not to spend $100,000 buying a house and then spending $1,000 a month more than you could rent for. Like in my mind, I think of that as losing money. You are, even the principal you're paying down in that house isn't enough to make up for the savings in rent, right? You could take all those dollars And instead of investing them into a house that doesn't actually produce anything, you could take those dollars and you could put them into starting a business. Mm. And that business, if you took $100,000, you could start, let's say, a pressure washing business. And with that $100,000 that you're now leveraging into equipment and marketing and all these things, what if the next year it produced $200,000 or $100,000, right? Like, it's just about how do you learn how to allocate your resources, your time, your energy, and your financial resources in a way that produces more resources, right? And just blindly putting them into a house for 99% of people is not the right answer. The 1% that can do that are the ones who make, you know, $1 million, $2 million, $5 million, $10 million, $100 million a year. Because like I said, they're making enough money based on what they're creating in the marketplace where they don't have to think about buying a house from a quantitative standpoint. They're just doing it based on the qualitative standpoint because they want it, right? And so again, this message is probably not helpful for most people because most people aren't going to, you know, they want to have a safe job. They want to have a safe income. That's fine. I have nothing against that. But for me, my focus in my life has been like, how do I live a life that's not like that? How do I live a life where I feel like I'm thriving? Like my upside is never capped. It's never limited. And the way that we do that is we have to go back to what we talked about in our last conversation, value creation. And then we talk about sequencing. And then we talk about how do we get to the point where we own assets and what assets are worth owning. So it's not that a house is an asset that's not worth owning. It's just the least productive asset most people will ever own. And so when you are going to spend way more money owning a house than renting a house, I believe you're better off investing that money into some asset that will produce more income, more revenue, more wealth than the house that you would buy. I don't know. That was a long rant. So I don't know if
that's interesting. I mean, let's talk about that for a second. So you brought up that you're saving $1,000 a month on rent versus buying a home. So let's say we have $12,000 each year. And let's say you wait 3 years, you have $36,000. With that kind of money, what sort of assets would you see would be a good opportunity to multiply? You talked about them briefly. You said one of them would be starting a business. Another one would be investing in your skills to learn an AI class or whatever. One of them, like there's options, but what kind of do you see would be a good option?
Well, I just did some quick math on a calculator. Let's say you just took the $36,000 after the 3 years, or let's say you put it in a little bit at a time. The math's a little off here, but you'll get the point. And then let's say you put it into the S&P 500 in an index fund. And let's say that grew 8% a year for 25 years. In 25 years, that $36,000 is $250,000. So I don't know. I mean, your house is probably not going to grow at 8% a year, right? Mm. Now, if you bought a rental house and somehow you found a rental house where you could make some cash flow, which is hard to do right now, the reason that the rental house is probably better to buy than the personal residence is because the tenants are going to pay off the mortgage. And at the end of that same 25 years, or let's say we kicked it out to 30 years, you would own the house free and clear. Plus the house would have gone up in value. Plus you get the cash flow. See, that's why buying investment real estate works. It's not because like people always compare real estate to the stock market. It's like, listen, that's two different things. Buying investment real estate is more like buying a dividend stock because it's paying you cash flow along the way. So my point is I want to help your generation and help my generation understand that buying a house when you could buy a house for less, like your monthly payment was less than you could rent a house for, made a lot of sense, right? Like for obvious reasons. Buying a house when your mortgage payment is 50% higher than your rental payment, unless you just have enough money where you don't care, it's just not a good financial decision. And the reason that people keep doing it is because we have not given people any financial literacy about how to allocate capital, how to invest their money. And so they're like, I don't know what else to do with my money. So I'm just going to like, I'll put it in a house. I know that's easy. And so that's what most people do. And over time, it works out for most of them if they can keep it. But it only works out for most of them when you don't compare it to what they would have made somewhere else, right? Because really what investing is, Warren Buffett is one of the best capital allocators of all time. And what that means is if he has 10 options of where to put his capital, he consistently is going to pick the best one or two. And that's why he can compound wealth for a long period of time at substantially higher rates of return than other people, because other people, they allocate to like the fourth or the fifth or the sixth or the seventh best option. And he does it to the first and the second. And so my point is, if we just go back to where we started in this conversation, what does it look like to thrive on one income? Well, it starts with being able to make the one income that doesn't require the second income. And I think an impediment to doing that in many cases right now would be to go lock yourself into a home where your mortgage payment gives you very little flexibility in terms of your ability to take risk to grow your income. Because the first thing that we're trying to solve for is a one-income household. A one-income household is going to require you to be a salesperson. It's going to require you to be an executive. It's going to require you to be in upper-level management. It's going to require you to do things and get things that most people don't do and don't get. And I think that what locks people into the standard path is when they lock themselves in with debt so they can't take the risks required to get the things that most people aren't going to get, right? You want to make what most people don't, you're going to have to take risks most people won't. It's hard to do that when you're stuck into a loan or several loans and you feel like you can't take any risks. So even if you didn't put any of that money into something else and it just sat in your bank account being devalued as you had inflation eating away at it, you would still have something that you couldn't have locked in with debt, which is the ability to take risks because you knew you had a big old pad in your bank account if something went wrong. And so for me, that's just how I look at it.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think it's, for me, when I'm looking at it, it's the advice that I commonly hear, and you've spoken about it some to this point of, you know, buying a house is your greatest asset or whatever. That's the term, right? I feel like if we were to look back in time, the reason why people are giving that advice maybe, and the reason why I appreciate your advice now is because maybe there was a point in time where buying your house was giving you the how to thrive, right? So if we go back to it, it's how do we thrive off one income? Maybe it was 30, 40, 50 years ago where you could buy a house, you could thrive off one income, and that advice was valuable at that point in time. But the advice that you're giving now is conducive of the times now. It's conducive of the numbers that we talked about, the priorities of sequencing that is probably going to lead to what we're actually talking about of the American dream in 2026 of what does that look like. And I think if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, it's really just sort of delayed gratification in a sense of the fact of the matter is, which you pointed out, is there is inflation going on and it's not going to change. And understanding that is going to allow you to take an accurate and understanding assessment of risk when you get to the point where you can actually have capital saved. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's really close. I think, so when you, right at the beginning, you said that it used to be that you hear often that your largest asset is your house. And see, yes, that's what people are told all the time. That's the truth for most people, but it shouldn't be that way. Mm. And part of the reason that people find themselves in the position they do is because they've been lied to in that way, right? So think about it. Let's say that you end up, you're 75 years old someday, and somebody told you that the best thing to do is buy a house. And so you put all this extra money into owning this house. And then let's say you're 75 and now the house is worth $1.5 million. And let's say all you have in your retirement, which this is the case for many people, is you got Social Security, which by the time we're there probably won't exist. But let's just say it did.
Yeah.
And let's say your Social Security was going to pay you $4,000 or $5,000 a month. But let's say you realistically need $7,000 or $8,000 at this point to retire on. Well, you don't have it, but you got this house worth $1.5 million. So what are you going to do? You're going to take out an equity line or a reverse mortgage, or you're going to sell the house, you're going to downsize, and you're going to live off this for a while. That's what the position of your house is your biggest asset gets a lot of people. Mm. Okay. It gets them it gets them cash poor and house rich. And I'm not saying that that's inherently bad, but what I am saying is that there are other ways where you will thrive much more. And it would be where your biggest asset is never your home, right? Because what I'm interested in is helping people realize that your largest asset and most of your wealth should never come from your home. It should be from the assets that you own that produce value in the marketplace that other people would like to own because of the value they create in the marketplace. That would be businesses, that would be rental properties, that would be stocks, that would be bonds even, because not that I own bonds or not very many of them, but it's like these are dollars that are being utilized to create value in the marketplace. And I want to help people realize that, like, buying into this, I don't want to call it a lie, but I don't know what else to call it. Buying into the lie that your home should be your biggest asset will lead you to a place where you probably aren't feeling like you're thriving at some point. And even in the beginning, right? Like if you're spending an extra 50% on your monthly payment, you probably aren't going to feel like you're thriving, especially if to make that payment, you need to make $10,000 a month and you're making $8,000 a month. You're going to feel pretty stressed out, right? Mm-hmm. There's nothing thriving in that. Now, there are other ways to thrive. And I'm not saying it's always that way, right? But in this example, I don't think that's the path to thrive. I think the path to thrive is go invest in your skills, go become more valuable, go create more value in the marketplace, get paid more as a result, so that then when you go to buy that $500,000 house with the same mortgage payment, it doesn't really bother you and it's not very stressful because you're making, let's say, 50% or 100% more than you were the first time around that you thought about it. And so yes. And then the second part you said is it just delayed gratification? Yeah, in many ways it is. But that's what capital allocation is all about, right? Allocating resources. Like Warren Buffett says, the difference between an investor and a speculator is this. A speculator is primarily concerned with what the price of an asset is going to be. An investor is primarily concerned with what the underlying production of the asset will be, right? So they're looking at everything on a different timeline. See, when we have a scarcity of time mentality, we think, oh my God, if I don't own a house when I'm 20 like my mom, then I'm missing out on something, right? That's time scarcity. Like, oh, I'm going to run out of time. And so what? So then you go do the thing that you thought you needed to do. And then that creates enough stress in your life because you did it too early or you did it when you shouldn't have done it, that then it just took away the very thing that you thought it was going to give you, right? Whereas if you're like, oh, I'm going to live till I'm 90. I'm not in a hurry to do these things. Instead, I'm going to think about what's the underlying conditions of the things that I'm investing into going to produce, and I invest differently than my parents and differently than my grandparents because I'm living in a different world and a different reality, and I allocate my resources differently. And then the very thing that they told me that was going to buy me that I've realized it probably won't, at least in this environment, I go and I reallocate over here. And I get, that's why I asked you, if you were making enough to do these things but renting a house, would you feel pretty successful? And you said yes, because that's what needs to be the focus instead of how do I buy a house. Because getting into that house, I know somebody right now in my family who believed the very thing you've been told. They went out, they stretched themselves, they bought a house, they lost a job. Now that house is a real stress. It's a real burden, right? And yeah, that's part of the risk of buying a house. I'm not saying you never take it. I'm just saying, like, if this person were renting, right, and they were just stacking cash, instead of feeling the stress, they would just have an extra, like, 20, I don't know, 10 grand in their bank account, and they would just move somewhere else, right? Or they would just move in with a friend. No, they've given themselves a runway. And so to me, I think that the two things is I want to help people make it to where their largest asset is not their home. And I want to help people understand, especially your generation and my generation, that time scarcity is one of the most crippling kinds of scarcity that we can adopt. And we've been indoctrinated in it. We've been told our whole lives that if we don't do things by this time, that somehow we're missing out. And the reality is, if we live our entire lives like that, we'll live our entire lives in a rush, constantly stressed out about time. And even if we accomplish all the goals, they'll always feel rushed. So it won't feel very good. And I don't think we have to live that way.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think you're definitely hitting something there where I feel like buying a house is so much, oftentimes, especially first home buyers like my wife and I, is so much of an emotional thing. And I feel like what you're talking about is making that tactical decision, like a non-emotional decision, to get to the point of, man, a lot of times it is an emotional decision, but being in the position to be like, okay, tactically this makes sense, and I can emotionally be invested in this home buying process, right? You know, and one other thing that you said that stood out to me is like, part of that tactical decision, part of that, you know, delayed gratification that we talked about is, I think it was, I can't remember if you said this to me or if it was somebody else, but it was talking about building your wealth, building your revenue, like we're talking about, and getting to the point where you can be, like capitalize on this opportunity is, there's two ways to build the tallest tower is the way they talk about this. It's, and when you consider the tallest tower, you think of, you know, creating the most value in the marketplace or, you know, something like that. There's two ways to do that. It's either building your tallest tower, building yourself up, or tearing everybody else down. And I think, you know, I don't think that there's definitely going to be the people that we're talking to here that are like, man, there's everybody else got this and I didn't get it, or, you know, and there's people in the past, my mom got her house at 20. I should be feeling that way. We're kind of dancing around this idea a little bit here. But I think one of the biggest things is the people that we're talking to are the ones that are be like, I need to grow with the curve. I want to be on the right side of the curve. I want to understand that capital allocation and asset retention, all that stuff is important to making it the absolute informed decision on, you know, I want these emotional things in my life. I want the American dream, like we've talked about, but making it in the decision that it is going to be hard and difficult, and you got to increase your wealth to be able to do it, to be able to actually get the things that you want.
Yeah. And you also have to remember that, like, even poor people in America today live better than middle-class people did 100 years ago, or yeah, like kings did 300 years ago. So, yeah. So I think, you said one word you said several times in that last bit was emotions or emotional. And the thing that people have to understand is the worst way to make financial decisions is emotionally. And we have trained generation after generation in America to view everything in light of their emotions, right? And it's not that our emotions aren't important. It's just we have to understand that oftentimes our emotions are tricking us or trying to trick us. And so, you know, my wife and I, as you know, we built two of what were supposed to be our dream homes over the last 6 years. And then we sold them both. And then we moved to Florida and are just now moving into our new house. And so many people have asked us, well, like, God, didn't it kill you to sell these homes that you spent 2 years building for each one and that you thought were going to be your forever homes? It's like, no, because I'm not emotional about them. Yeah. And maybe some people think that that's weird, and maybe they think that I should be or whatever. But my point is not that your home shouldn't be emotional. It can be, right? And we love our home. But my point is that your attachment to it from the financial standpoint should never be emotional. You should never be making financial decisions rooted in emotion. You should always be allowing your logical mind and your ability to do basic math and understand how to allocate resources effectively and efficiently. That's what should be driving 95% of your financial decisions, right? Yeah, there's a time and a place where you can certainly let your emotions run wild, but as it relates to your money. But most of the time, right, we want to be making our financial decisions rooted in reality. And so I think that's a thing, is like going into this reality of we're going to live through chaos, inflation, deflation, booms, busts. And we might be going into a time where there are no more busts. It's just booms, because they're just going to keep printing money into oblivion. I mean, we'll see, right? But the point is, how can we help people? How can we help people actually navigate that kind of a life? How can we help people actually thrive in those environments? And the reality is, I think what's good, and then you add AI and robotics into that mix, and you go, okay, well, the way that I think I could help people is helping them to understand that if you really want to thrive, if you really want to live what used to be considered sort of normal, it's going to be imperative that you, one, understand the financial reality that you're living in, and two, actually learn something about that financial reality. And then three, that you start figuring out how to actually get paid based on your production and then investing into productive assets. Because if you look at like the value goes down of the dollar goes down 10%, and at the same time, the value in the stock market goes up, or the value in companies goes up, right? And it's not because they're getting more valuable. It's because the money that we're using is getting less valuable. And so there is a financial reality to these things. And I don't want to say this in a way where people start getting overwhelmed and they check out. And that's why I always go back to you and I go, so really what it comes down to is you figure out how to get paid more and you can figure out a lot of this other stuff as you go, right? Mm. But the reality is like, and here's the thing, I just thought about this. I think one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this is because when I was about your age, or just a little older than you, I bought my business. I bought into one of my businesses. And then over the next couple of years after that, I bought the rest of it. And I'll never forget, I went in, I was 25 years old, and I'm like, man, these guys are spending money. Like, they've been running this business for 25 years. They are all financially free. Like, they don't care. They're not being frivolous with the books, yeah. But like, they're just not being that, you know, anal about them. And I'm going, we could cut this and this and this. And so I go in there and I just start cutting out the waste. And then I get through it and I was like, okay, well, there's nothing left to cut. Right. And we're in the Great Recession. We're like in the middle of it. This is like early 2000 or late 2009, early 2010. And I'm like, oh, I got it. You can't cut yourself to wealth. You can't cut yourself to prosperity. You have to grow. You have to produce. You have to actually go out and like generate more revenue and serve more people. And you have to actually bring in more dollars, because you can only cut so far and then you can't cut any farther. And I think we're hitting it right here. This is the message that I've been wanting to send, is that in your daily life, man, as you gave me the list of things you desire, there's only so many of those things you can cut back on until you really feel like life's tough. So is there a place for frugality? Yes, there's always a place for frugality. But you know what should take a higher place than frugality is producing, is going out into the marketplace, being valuable, getting paid for the value you create, because that's how you're going to get the kind of life that you desire, the kind of life that's possible. It's not going to be through cutting coupons and nickel and dime. I mean, you can do that. And there's a place for that. And if people are in debt and they're overspending, they should start there. But for people who are being financially realistic and reasonable, the solution isn't to look at your budget and go like, how do I carve out another $100? The solution is to look at your skills and look at where you're spending your time and your effort and your energy and going, how do I go produce some stuff in the marketplace where I can make an extra $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $10,000, $100,000? Because I learned in my business life, in the reality of my businesses, that's really how it works.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. One thing I'd add, I just kind of pointed it out, and what you said is you said you don't want to carve out that $100 in the context that you said. But I think one note that it is like, if you're going to carve out that $100, because I know you're not saying don't cut, you said it's okay to be frugal, there's to an extent. If you do carve out that $100, where is that going to go to create $1,000? Right? So I think that's like, I think the point that you're kind of making is if you're cutting, it's also got to be towards the overall goal of what is it going to actually create by cutting that?
Yeah, precisely. And I would say everything comes back to this idea of allocating resources. So when we think about the allocation of energy as a resource, which is ultimately the resource, right? Everything comes out of the energy available, right? That's why all the people who want to shut off the oil and all that, it's just mind-boggling to me, because wealth comes out of energy. So when we think about in our own personal lives, we only have so much energy. And there are things that suck our energy so that we're not productive, and there are things that give us energy so we are like triple productive. So my point is yes, it's important to be frugal. Yes, it's important to figure out where to cut the $100. But there's a diminishing return, at which point you are so obsessed with how to cut more things that you're being drained of all your energy versus spending that same energy figuring out how to actually create more things that solve the problem to where you wouldn't have to be so focused on cutting the things, right? Mm. It's about allocating your energy. It's about allocating your time. It's about allocating your focus and your attention into the things that will grow. And by growing, solve the problem you're trying to solve instead of stressing about like, where else can I cut when there's nowhere else to cut, right? Or where cutting more is not as beneficial. It has a diminishing return versus producing more versus creating more. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do. And I think now's a good time to maybe, so if we go back to the $80,000 a year HVAC technician, our guy, whatever, John Doe, let's say he is sitting here and watching this and he's saying, let's try to bundle this up if we can. Like, what does that look like for the $80,000 technician who's saying, okay, I want to start making smart financial decisions and I want to be able to thrive, right? That's the goal, is like, I want to be able to thrive. And even though right now it's on the right side of the bell curve, it is attainable. So like, what does the $80,000 technician go from? Okay, I understand now how to increase my revenue. I know I need to create value, but what is that next part?
Yeah, I think the next part, if we're talking about financially, is to sit down and figure out where you're spending your money, right? And then, so let's just do an example. Let's say you're making $7,000 a month and you got $5,000 a month left over after taxes. So let's say your rent's $2,000. You got $3,000 left. Let's say you got a $500 car payment. Now you got $2,500 left. Let's say between your insurance and your cell phone and all that jazz, I don't know, let's say it's another $500. Now you got $2,000. And then you got to eat. Let's say you spend $1,000 eating. Let's say you got $1,000 left. Okay. Well, then the question is, out of the $4,000 that we've spent from the $5,000 we had, is there anything we can cut? Probably not a lot. Maybe the $500 car payment. But this is my point. My point is, if you could sit there and stress all this time on how to get rid of the $500 car payment or how to trade your car in and hopefully you're not upside down, and then how could you pay cash for a junker? It's like, I don't think that's the answer, man. I think the answer is like, okay, how do I go from 8,000? Because now I've got $1,000 left over. I can be investing $1,000. I can be investing it into the S&P 500. I can be investing it into my own education, my own training, my own side hustle, whatever. But now I go, okay, how do I go from 7,000 a month to 10,000 a month? Right. And this is where, going back to our last video, it's like there's only so many options. The HVAC tech could probably become a project manager or some sort of a manager. The HVAC tech could go start a side business or do side jobs. The HVAC tech could go into a completely different field, starting his own business or into a sales role. But it's like the reality for most people is, if you want to make $120,000 a month, or a month, if you want to make $120,000 a year, $10,000 a month, there's only so many things you can do. So if I'm the HVAC tech, I'm looking at my bills, because let's say he's got $1,000 in credit card debt. So now he's spending all of his $5,000. Well, then my first priority is, I got to get rid of my credit card debt.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm probably going to do that while doing my HVAC job, because I need some stability to get that paid off. And let's say I can pay it off in a year. Then I'm focused on that first. Because that debt will ruin me. The stress, the rate that they charge me, all that. So I'm focused on that first. And then I'm focused on, where can I put my $1,000 a month? And what I would probably do, just thinking out loud, is I'd probably put like 500 of that into my 401k if they're offering me that and they're going to do a match. And I would probably take the other 500 and I would invest it in myself or into a side hustle. Because I truly believe, like, the people that I can help, the people that we're going to talk to, if you're not a salesperson, if you're not an executive in a company, if you're not a high-level manager, you got to be a business owner. Those are the roles that I see, or very specialized, right? A dentist, an attorney, a doctor. Like, those are the people who are going to make the kind of money that we're talking about. And so this HVAC tech, to answer your question, I'm going, make sure you're not overspending. If you are overspending, you got to figure out where you can cut back. But then you got to get to, like, home base, what's necessary. And from there, it's, how do I grow? And for the HVAC tech, it's literally get a promotion, start a side hustle, start your own business, or some combination of the three. And I don't think that there's very many other options in that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I mean, I guess we could probably leave it at that. That gives me an idea at least to move forward too, because, you know, I'm in the HVAC tech position right now. Of like, man, I want to go to the next step. So I'm taking it.
So here, I want to give, because I think in our first video or our last video, we didn't talk about what's the number. And so what I want to say is, what's the number? So this life that we talked about where you got a home, whether it's one you rent or you own, you got a car, you can go out to dinner, you can do your hobbies. Let's just say that to do that comfortably, you need $12,000 to $15,000 a month. Let's just say. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's probably going to be less in some places. It's going to be way more in other places. But just let's say the average across the board is, let's say, $12,000. Then you just have to sit there and go, listen, the easiest way, at least in my mind, the easiest way to make $12,000 a month is to go get paid for what you know you produce, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're in construction, like I know people who are project managers in the construction business on the commercial side, and they're getting paid a base salary plus a commission, right? Mm-hmm. So if they hit their budget numbers and the project has a certain level of spread, they get whatever, 5% of something, right? And then it's just doing the math. It's like, if you're not in the construction business and that's not an option, don't sit around and just hem and haw about it or get mad about it. Sit there and go, okay, well, salespeople, right? They get paid based on what they produce. How could I sell stuff? Or business people, they get paid based on what they produce. What kind of business could I start? And I think in a future conversation, in the very near future, we'll talk about what does it actually take to run a successful business. So maybe for people who are interested in that, we can offer some help. But I do think that if you want to live this life, if you want to feel like you're thriving, if you want to do it on one income, I think in your brain, in most places in this country, with the exception of some of the most expensive, you're probably going to have to make $12,000 to $15,000 a month. And the easiest path to do that, or the most reliable path to do that, is go put yourself in a role where you have some skin in the game, where you're going to get paid based on what you bring through the door. And I think if you do that, you commit to that, you learn the skills necessary to do that, I think it's totally doable. Well, if you're still watching or listening, we appreciate you checking out this week's conversation. And if you liked it, we'd love for you to hit that like button. And if you want to follow along for more of our conversations, just go ahead and subscribe. And as always, if you found this valuable and you think somebody that you know could benefit from it, we'd love it if you'd share it. That's how we get the word out. And we appreciate you being here. We'll see you next week.